Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam and I get to talk with founder and president of the National Fabry Disease Foundation, Jerry Walter, about hope for rare diseases through the case of Fabry disease.
You know, Christy, it's so rare that we're able to talk about advances in the treatment of rare diseases. And this is a something that really should warm us, something that was not treatable in the distant past. And it is treatable today and maybe gives us hope for a lot of our listeners out there whose family members maybe have some rare diseases. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Absolutely, I am too. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about medications for children's migraines.
And all of us have who've had children know that headaches happen with kids. We'll also be talking about kids who have the funny-looking heads, and what do we do about that?
And we'll talk about acupuncture for seasonal allergies.
And finally, some groundbreaking research just reported in the New England Journal of Medicine about preventing heart disease with a Mediterranean diet.
So first, let's jump into headaches and children. This is a problem for a lot of children. About 2% of children and 7 to 10% of older kids and teenagers get migraine headaches. And the question is, do medications that work for adults also work for children?
This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's journal Pediatrics. And these researchers from Wisconsin looked at 21 different trials that compared different headaches drugs to each other or to what is called the placebos in children who had migraines to see if the treatment with these drugs was better than the placebos in preventing headaches. What did you think before you looked at it, Christy?
Well, you know, it's funny because I just prescribed an 18-year-old, technically an adult, but, you know, an older teenager, one of these medications who I was eager to see. They looked at 21 different trials, and what they found is that many of the headache prevention medicines used for adults did not work for children, but that there's one medicine called Topamax or topiramate, which is a seizure medicine, and trazodone, another sleep medicine, that did significantly reduce the frequency of headaches in kids and teens.
Yeah, I think the fact that many of the medicines that are used in adults did not work that well in the kids indicates that maybe we should reassess how we treat headaches in children and in kids, because the placebos worked pretty darn well. And there was something about really listening and helping the kids believe that their headaches were taken seriously that seemed to really provide some benefit, not necessarily the medications. That's a take-home for me.
It is true. And there's also, it raises questions about placebos and some ethical dilemmas. Is it okay to give children something or make them feel like they're getting something? We decide it's not really okay to do that with adults.
We give them candy all the time,
don't we? I mean, we do it all the time.
If you'll be quiet in church or synagogue, you get a piece of candy, right? And that works for at least 30 seconds.
Yeah, it does raise some issues. But placebos are almost as good or as good as many of the medicines. I was happy to see that Topamax medicine that did work better than placebo happened to be the one I just prescribed for that teenager. So that was good news.
And this
hopefully will work.
I agree. And this does not really include the medicines to treat migraines if you have it in children. And there are medications like the drug Imitrex that is frequently used to treat the migraines. We're talking about preventing the migraines. So maybe less drugs for some of our youth and kids. Our very next research that matters, that was in the Journal of Pediatrics, about the size and the shape of the head, where sometimes it's not normal.
So the number of head deformities, the fancy word for this is plagiocephaly. The number,
better say that one again, Christy. You got me on that one.
Plagiocephaly. We'll
ask
her.
That's not like plagiarism. That's this.
No, no, it's plagiocephaly. And that's a misshapen head. The number of these deformities rose from 5% during the 90s to up to 20 to 30% in 2008. And that's because we had the success with the Back to Sleep campaign. Put the babies on their back and they're less likely to die from SIDS, but
sudden infant death syndrome,
exactly.
That sudden stoppage of breathing and heart, and kids die, tragedy among tragedies, keep them on their back the whole time. They don't get that sudden infant death syndrome, but their head flattens out like a pancake.
Exactly. And this was a problem.
Not a good thing.
My oldest daughter had this problem, and her head, you know, was just really flat on one side. And at the time, the best treatment option for her, because it can have dental effects and other things when your whole face sort of starts to change, was to do these helmets. And the helmet you have to wear constantly to school, or to play school, or to church and sleep in it. And it can shape your head back as the baby grows, but they're costly. Insurance doesn't pay for it. And it's
and I'm sure none of the other kids at school noticed it at daycare at all, right?
Everyone would stare at me at church and sort of think,
what did you do to your child? What
did
you do? You had seizures or something. And so this is like one of those common sense areas of research that I really liked it. And they really looked at, well, what happens if you take babies who have these moderate to severe head deformities, and then you, instead of using these helmets, do some stretching exercises or pillows that help prevent and soften, and does most of this go away? And the good news was, it does. I really like that.
I really do, too. And it turned out true. My second baby, I was all about the different pillows and repositioning, and he didn't have the problem. That's my N of two children. But this team looked at 50 different babies who had the head deformities and found that those repositioning strategies and stretching really do make a difference.
And really, within 5 to 7 months, you often begin to see spontaneous improvements. So this research doesn't prove it, because they didn't do a randomized controlled trial on it.
Right.
But I think this is common sense. It's a lot less expensive to do some stretching exercises and some pillows than it is to get the helmet. And Christy, you did the best you could.
Thank you. Well, her head
it
is beautiful
easy.
Now.
It She's
is
got
perfect.
Beautiful children.
Let's talk about acupuncture and allergies. So seasonal allergic rhinitis is the fancy term for when you have allergies that make your nose run.
And this was some research that really looked to see if those who have these really seasonal allergies, kind of like the about to have pollen season and people will be sneezing and rubbing and all over the place, if for those patients, acupuncture actually provides them with benefit.
And they looked at 422 people, provided 12 treatments over 8 weeks in the first year, and compared that to people who got sham acupuncture, where they got the acupuncture in the wrong spots, to see if it improved their scores or their symptom scores that affect their lives.
And the sham acupuncture compared with the real acupuncture was not as good. And the real acupuncture did have a statistically significant benefit compared to the sham, but the clinically, it was a very small difference. And the question really to me is, does that justify the expense of the acupuncture? Because this was in a very controlled trial. Would we see these good results in our own practice? I don't think so. What do you think, Christy?
Well, I think it raises questions, and it's probably about even. I can't say this is overwhelming evidence to support it, but it's a pretty simple treatment. And for people who either can't tolerate the antihistamine medicines or are not getting relief with the medicines that are available, I think this is an option for patients who can afford it and who want to try. There's very little risk to it, and it might be helpful for some people. That's my take on it.
That is a reasonable approach. And let's talk about reasonable approaches, our very last research that matters. A major new article in the New England Journal of Medicine about Mediterranean diet, which Christy and I talk about a lot, but this time really one of the first studies looking, can it actually prevent heart disease among those at high risk of developing heart disease.
This was a multi-center trial in Spain, and that means they did it in lots of different clinics and medical centers where they randomly assigned participants who were at high risk for heart disease but who didn't have heart disease at the time to different diets and followed them over time to see the rate of heart events like heart attack, stroke, or death from heart disease.
And these patients got assigned randomly to this Mediterranean diet supplemented with olive oil, a Mediterranean diet supplemented with mixed nuts, or a diet where they were just advised to reduce the dietary fat. And before we tell you what they found, we should say what the Mediterranean diet is, which is high intake of olive oil, nuts, vegetables, cereals, a little bit of fish and poultry, and a low intake of dairy products, red meat, processed meats, and sweets, along with wine in moderation.
And what they found was that among the people, and there were almost 7,500 people enrolled, among the people who had high risk for heart disease, eating a Mediterranean diet supplemented with either extra virgin olive oil or nuts reduced their incidence or their chance of getting major heart events.
Yeah, significantly.
I mean,
they ended this study early. They did an interim analysis after a couple of years and found like 20% less chance of these folks having heart attacks. It didn't completely eliminate it, but boy, was this powerful. And I think this gives us a new tool, because if we had a medicine, if we had a pill to give people that caused 20% less heart attacks, and it was found in these trials, people would be on the pill. So I think we're going to have some real serious conversations about, do we actually prescribe this like we do a pill?
I love it. And I mean, it's relatively simple and could really improve the health of our nation if we could all take steps to eat more healthy. And in this fact, a Mediterranean diet is good for you to prevent heart disease.
We'll ask our librarians at the Health Sciences Library to maybe post links to this Mediterranean diet. But that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with the founder and president of the National Fabry Disease Foundation, Jerry Walter, about hope for rare diseases, the case of Fabry disease. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, I'm going to have an opportunity to talk with Jerry Walter, the founder and president of the National Fabry Disease Foundation, about hope for rare diseases, the case of Fabry disease. Welcome to Your Health, Jerry.
Thank you, Adam. It's a pleasure to be here today.
And I'm sorry for this conversation. Christy can't be with us, but I know she is equally really interested in the story and the information that you're bringing to Your Health listeners. Tell us just a little bit about how you came to really be interested in the story of Fabry disease. And I know it's a personal issue.
Right. Well, to begin with, I have Fabry disease myself. So I'm a 58-year-old male with classic Fabry disease. And because it's a genetic disorder, my family has Fabry disease. So we got Fabry disease from my mother, myself, and 4 siblings. And there are 18 people in our extended family, immediate and extended family, that have Fabry disease.
So let's define for our listeners, because when we talk about Fabry disease, probably the great majority of our listeners, probably the great majority of my colleagues, may not have heard of it. What is Fabry disease, and is it, as we would think of, rare?
Right. Well, most people haven't heard of Fabry disease because it's one of the about 7,000 rare genetic disorders.
7,000.
7,000. Right.
7,000 in total may not be rare.
Right. So, and it's rare because by definition, we have supposedly under 1 in 200,000 people in the United States. And so our disease, it's an enzyme deficiency, which is stops the body from disposing of a fatty substance in the body, a lipid in the body, and so it accumulates over our lifetime. And we're finding out with our disease, it's not so rare even that a lot more people have Fabry disease than once thought, because there's been some widespread studies in Italy, Taiwan, Austria that tell us, paint a picture that it's still going to be considered a rare disorder, but not nearly as rare as what people think it is now. It could be 10 to 20 times more prevalent than current statistics, which are about 1 in 50,000 males.
And why is it called Fabry disease? I'm sure you know that answer. I don't.
Well, two doctors found Fabry disease at the same year in different places. One was a German and one was an Englishman, and so it's been called Anderson Fabry disease for years. And somehow along the way, it just got it got named Fabry for short, which puzzles the heck out of most of us, because you can say Fabry 100 different ways. And Fabry, you know, you can guess how many different ways you could pronounce that. But Anderson's pretty simple. So we all wished it was really called Anderson's disease. It'd make it a lot simpler for us.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you want a disease to be named after you or not, but certainly this disease is one that there's a lot of information about. So you said this is accumulation of an abnormal enzyme in the body. When do people know, when does that process start? As soon as someone is born, or does this happen as a variation after someone reaches a certain age?
It starts before birth. So the actual accumulation of the lipids and damage to cells happens before birth. But of course, it's considered, you know, progressive, destructive, life-threatening. And so over time, it starts out very early in children, where children will experience quality of life symptoms like neuropathic pain. We don't sweat properly, so we overheat easily. We don't tolerate physical activity and exercise or heat. We have chronic GI problems. We have a myriad of quality of life symptoms in childhood that usually are not recognized by physicians. So many of the things that the symptoms that we have, you could attribute to something else. Even, you know, things like growing pains. When a child complains of burning or other kinds of pain in their hands and feet, no one can really explain why. And Fabry disease, because it's so rare, never comes to mind. And so it's overlooked for years and years and years. And then later in life, when the bad, you know, the worst things start happening, even then the symptoms are much like other things. So we get early heart attacks, early strokes, early kidney failure, severe hearing loss. The other symptoms continue, chronic pain, chronic GI problems, but there's so many things there are symptoms that are like other conditions that it's hard to put all the pieces together and come up with a diagnosis. So some people have Fabry disease their entire life and suffer all of these things and sometimes die at a young age and never realize what they have.
And you have lots of people in your family. How did the story start within the family?
Well, so my mother went into the hospital with something completely unrelated, and an astute physician recognized a whirling pattern that people with Fabry disease have in their eyes.
Whirling pattern.
Yes, it's like they call it in the medical term is corneal verticillata. We call it corneal whirling or corneal opacities.
And we better get our health sciences librarian we'll get them to spell that out for us, and maybe we can put a link up on our site so we can see a picture of what
right.
that might look like.
And there are pictures on our website of corneal verticillata. So that's just one of the many ways we can be diagnosed. But my mother, a physician, just stumbled onto the corneal whirling, and that led to a testing for Fabry, which led to family testing. And that's how many families are found. But there are really a lot of ways to diagnose someone with Fabry disease. We have an eye finding, a skin rash that are telltale signs, and then many other clues along the way.
Well, you mentioned kidney disease and heart disease, which are two common end-stage consequences of having Fabry disease, but those are very common in the general population. So if you had high blood pressure, you might have both of those problems, or diabetes, you might have both of those problems, but both of those problems could then be also caused by something else like Fabry disease. So how do people who are sitting out there thinking, oh my goodness, I have some heart, I have some kidney, when does the foundation recommend that the public start to think, could I have something different?
Well, that's exactly right. You hit on it. You said that many people have heart disease and diabetes, and they have high blood pressure. So if you have a person with early heart disease and they don't have high blood pressure, we should test for Fabry disease. If you have a person with kidney disease without diabetes, you should test for Fabry disease. If you have proteinuria early on in life, that's a really wide symptom for Fabry.
Excess many people protein have, in the urine.
Right. So if you have protein in the urine, you should test for Fabry disease. All of the things that you mentioned are common, but there's a little bit of a different twist with Fabry. There's the cause is not they're of unknown causes. So for instance, if a person has a transient ischemic attack or a stroke under the age of 55 of unknown causes, you should test for Fabry disease. In fact, there's statistics about all of those, about the percentage of how many people people that have strokes under the age of 55, 2.4% or something like that of males have Fabry disease as the underlying cause, and another statistic for females and so on.
So this is within that group of disorder of an enzyme, a lysosome disorders, and we've heard of medicine, most of us, all of us have heard of Gaucher disease as the most common one, but when one goes about testing for these types of disorders, what are the ways, if patients were interested, how do they get tested?
So Fabry disease, Gaucher disease, Pompe disease, some of the MPS diseases are all similar lysosomal storage disorders. And we all have a definitive genetic test. Our test is called the GLA test. And males can do an enzyme assay test, which means they're testing levels of enzyme, because a male with classic Fabry disease has less than 1% of the enzyme. So it's a definitive test. Whereas a female, because it's an X-linked disease, and a female can have, in every cell of her body, she'll have one X that's affected and one that's unaffected. So they have a mosaic distribution of Fabry disease in the body. So therefore, you can't test enzyme levels because they won't paint the right picture. But you can do a DNA test of the same gene, GLA gene, and do a DNA sequencing and definitively test a female for Fabry disease.
Well, this is incredibly interesting and important, because I think it suggests that we, and we'll hear after we take a short break, about the really success and the amazing progress that we've made in not only understanding the cause, but a treatment for this disease. And we're going to continue our conversation with Jerry Walter, president of the National Fabry Disease Foundation, about hope for rare diseases, the case of Fabry disease. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And I've been talking with the founder and president of the National Fabry Disease Association, Jerry Walter, about hope for rare diseases, the cases of Fabry disease. And Jerry, right before we took a break, you really described kind of the advances in diagnosis and in genetic testing that are available. And I guess it raises a question, is this part of the newborn screens that now can be done to diagnose these types of diseases? And if not, why not?
So I think the medical community has realize that newborn screening is very important for Fabry disease, because if you can get a child to treatment early, you can avoid many of the, not only the quality of life symptoms, but the really bad symptoms that come later in life. So far, there's been newborn screening in three countries that I know of, Italy, Taiwan, and Austria, and which is a good thing in and of itself, but have also, that's what caused us to think there's much more Fabry disease than anyone ever thought. And now there's pilot programs in Northwestern and in University of Washington, or two that I know of, and others that are starting that are also coming up with very high numbers of people with Fabry disease, much more than historically thought. And it really it's going to give children an opportunity to start treatment early, because, as I said earlier, most of what happens now is people get diagnosed much later after sometimes irreversible organ damage occurs. And so we are making a lot of progress, and we're also one of the, there's about 7,000 rare diseases, but fewer than 6% of those have a treatment.
Well, and that's a key ingredient towards a screen. From medically speaking, we don't necessarily screen for things that we can't intervene and offer a treatment. So help us understand, when did treatments first start becoming available, and what was that like? Did you know about your Fabry disease when there were before treatments were available?
Well, it happened about the same time. So I got a phone call offering to go into a clinical trial after I discovered I have Fabry disease in 2002. And so I was in a phase 3 clinical trial for an enzyme replacement therapy. And then in April of 2003, that treatment was approved by the FDA. So I've been on treatment for a little over 10 years now. And it's like things go, it's not perfect, but I have my heart is in significantly better condition. I've gone from chronic kidney disease stage 3 back to stage 1.
Wow.
I don't have all the arrhythmias that I used to have. My heart was getting a little bit hard to deal with, and many other things. We have so many symptoms. My legs don't swell nearly as much. Chronic GI problems are much better. Things have improved.
I mean, this is really kind of amazing, because one doesn't think about reversal of disease, much less treatments for some of these rare diseases in our lifetime. What was that day, that month, that year like when all of a sudden you knew that there was an effective treatment, even though there might be side effects?
Well, it was great. I mean, I went from having my long-term goals in life were very short, because now the estimate of a average age of death of a male is cited at about 50, untreated male at about 50. When I learned I had Fabry disease, it was 41. So I didn't start treatment until I was 48. So for many years, my long-term goals were very short-term goals, because I really didn't think that I was going to live very long. And even when I started treatment, I was 7 years past the statistical average age of death. At 58, now I'm 8 years past the statistical average age of death, after it had been revised. But we have a lot of hope. I mean, people can live a lot longer on treatment, and I'm evidence of that. I am a case where I've had significant improvements in my heart, and my kidneys have remained stable, which is, everyone's not that lucky, but, the earlier people start treatment, the more people we can get diagnosed with Fabry disease to enable treatment, the better off we are. It's a wonderful feeling to know that, I didn't expire so young.
Well, I know, and for our listeners out there, Jerry doesn't look a day over 53, and maybe even younger, and that just feels good. And I imagine for your family members that who have access to treatment, tell us about the treatment a little bit. And because my impression as a family physician is, when we come up with treatments for rare diseases, it's a great day, but we often underestimate the difficulties of some of these, because they're incredibly frequently expensive.
Right. Well, the expense is one issue. They're just to throw out a number, maybe $200,000 a year. And
for
the treatment of Fabry disease, for the enzyme replacement therapy, and for a guy my size. So, you know, it's based on I take 1 kilogram per milligram of the enzyme replacement therapy, which it's I do a biweekly every 2 weeks and. An infusion. So I sit in my case, we often sit in the oncology center and do infusions, but I'm now at Duke, for instance, it's separated and I'm in a different infusion center, so to speak. But we go in every 2 weeks. We sit in a chair for 4 or 5 hours. We get a boost of enzymes, artificial enzyme that goes in and clears some of the lipids out of our body. And it's a lifelong process. So,
I think if I'm a listener out here, I'm going, I am so glad and excited. $200,000 for a year? How do we deal with that?
Well, I think almost in all cases, it's paid for by insurance, especially now that we don't have lifetime caps. And so,
lifetime cap meaning they would pay for it, but only for the first 2 years.
Right. And also there's some support programs that help people with insurance premiums. So there's an organization, another nonprofit, that helps people with insurance premiums. So I've run into very few people that have not been able to have treatment paid for without out-of-pocket expenses. And of course, there are some exceptions to that. But for the most part, people are getting medication paid for by insurance companies with some ancillary support mechanisms. And even in our case, the foundation, we can't sustain long-term financial support. But if a person's in trouble and just can't get to their infusion, we'll help pay for that. We'll help with some ancillary medications.
Well, I want to get to the foundation in a second and your work with the foundation. But help me understand, I understand there are two companies that make similar medications here for infusion. And I know one of them had a major manufacturing problem, which created tremendous, I think, angst for and even worse for affected individuals. So help us understand the tug and flow of producing medications, the cost of those medicines, and where we go with that.
Well, and that's right. So we had a tough couple of years. So there are two medications made by two different companies available in the world, but both are not approved in the U.S. So a few years ago when we had a shortage of the primary of one of the medications that was available, the only one that was available in the U.S., the FDA allowed the second company of the drug that's not approved in the U.S. to come in and help fill the gap on some special clinical trials. And so that really helped out for quite a long time. And the end result of all of that was the second company still wasn't approved yet in the U.S. and is still not. And the other company that had the shortages are over and everyone's back to normal. But we had a really rough couple of years where people couldn't get their infusions. A lot of people's health deteriorated.
So the challenge ahead is really potentially finding ways to produce these medicines more reliably at less cost, really, for those. But that's a challenge for all these rare diseases because the companies seem to not be able to make enough money in the cost of development. Is that true?
Right. Well, I think that I think that the companies are making enough money to sustain manufacturing, but they have to, they have to have backup plans. They have to have stock on the shelf. They have to do the right things to make sure that we don't have another shortage. And we're fortunate in the, just like you mentioned, Gaucher disease, and I mentioned a couple of the other diseases, we all have these treatments, and there's a lot of interest in other treatments. So we have a lot of research going on. There's a chaperone therapy that's an oral form of medication that won't work for everyone because it only works on certain disease mutations, but that's undergoing clinical trials and trying to get FDA approval. Maybe we may or may not get that, but there's other gene therapy has just begun in Canada for the first time for Fabry disease clinical trials. So there's a lot of interest and a lot of research going on. So what we hope to have other choices. That's the answer, really. Other choices, other medications that we can, if something goes wrong with one, if we don't have one, we have another.
Well, in our last minute, Jerry, tell us what you do briefly with the work of the foundation, because this is, and I'm sure giving coming on and educating listeners is part of that work. But what's the foundation do to really educate the American public and providers and help patients and families who have Fabry disease, but also giving them hope for maybe other rare diseases?
Right. So it's being a rare disease, and it's hard to reach people, that especially the unknown community, the community that has Fabry and doesn't know it. We try things like just educating physicians and educating. For instance, I've gone around and shown my skin lesions, my skin finding called angiokeratoma, to over 700 dermatologists in a clinical setting. And we go, so we have some patient implemented programs where we go out, we try to get people to go out and show a doctor their eye finding or their skin finding so the doctor will recognize them more easily and diagnose. We try to reach families with situations. This is an ideal way to kind of reach out into the public and say, you know, if you've got a child that has chronic pain, chronic GI problems, doesn't sweat properly, overheats easily, all those things, we try to reach out to the community in any way we can. And we would love to do forums like this because we can reach small segments of the community and keep spreading the word. But it is very difficult to reach people that don't know they have Fabry and don't know it, or that even people that have Fabry, and because it's a rare disease and communication doesn't always flow that well in any medical community.
Really, on behalf of Christy and myself and our listeners to Your Health, we really appreciate your work with the foundation and your work as an individual, sharing your story and helping those who really may be suffering or don't even know they're suffering for this. That's a real blessing that you offer to others. So thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome, and thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
We've been talking with Jerry Walter, the president of the National Fabry Disease Foundation, about hope for rare diseases, the case of Fabry disease. And I hope that we can stay in touch, Jerry, and hear about continued success of the work that you do, and also make us all more sensitive to the 7,000 rare diseases across the U.S., which in total are not so rare.
That's right. Thank you so much.
Stay with us. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be talking about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can go to our health app and call and leave it directly on a voicemail. And Christy, we have some really good House Calls today about revised recommendations for Ambien,
and about using DEET for children for bug protection,
about a listener's thoughts about chiropractic care and what do we think,
and about stomach pain and problems in the mouth.
Well, let's listen to our very first question about a listener's experience with chiropractic care.
I've always thought that chiropractors dealt with spine and bone problems, but recently I've heard two people say that they've been cured of digestive issues by their chiropractor. One even said the chiropractor diagnosed her wheat allergy when the test her GI doctor did came up negative. I feel I should mention that both of these people are highly educated and in the healthcare field themselves. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, first off,
It's a loaded question.
It's a loaded question, and I we don't want to say that in face of the problems with gun violence in America. But for allopathic providers, these are family doctors trained, and chiropractic providers, which would be a different set of training skills. Frequently, we might have different opinions about not necessarily the treatment of bone disease or back problems or even neck problems with chiropractic manipulation, but for things like gastrointestinal problems, which are not really in the standard training of chiropractic care.
And I do have patients who feel like their chiropractor is helping them with their overall health and that they're getting good benefit from that. And so, you know, and I'm not one to just sort of discount something that might be helping an individual patient. But I do think when you're talking about ordering a bunch of blood tests, it's particularly when you're getting into allergy tests and things, that that it's important to be a little bit cautious about the value of these tests and how to interpret them.
Yeah, I will go say two things for certain. One is, if you felt better and you didn't spend a lot of money and it occurred through your chiropractic care or through your allopathic family doctor care, that's good care. I'm glad it didn't cost you a lot of money. You feel better. Common sense means that's good. On the other hand, if it's really expensive in either set of cares, there may be some problems with it or very invasive testing. In this particular case, they are better. Do I recommend go to a chiropractic care for nutritional means? No, I don't. I recommend working with a nutritionist, someone who has extensive training in nutrition specifically.
I would agree. Similar with allergy tests, there's the evidence is emerging and it's very confusing. And I would encourage you to work with an allergy specialist if you're talking about really getting into all those different blood markers that can be ordered. But thank you for your question. It really raises, it is loaded in some ways, but we're trying to have a middle ground here.
And maybe Christy and I should have a chiropractic provider on the show. And talk about a lot of issues, because I don't think this is just about chiropractic care. I think this is about the competency for anyone to do anything that they're trained for.
Absolutely.
You wouldn't find Christy and I talking about some issues that we have no real experience on. That's why we have some expertise with our guests. Thank you for that question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
What do you think about using DEET for children? We are going on vacation in warm weather, and I want to do the right thing.
You know, this is an area that is stressful for a lot of parents, because DEET is a chemical. It's a chemical that is in the bug sprays that is very effective to repel mosquitoes and prevent mosquito bites. Particularly if you're going to a South American country or somewhere far away with lots of different exotic bugs, it's something to think about.
Or even if you're going in your backyard where there's lots of ticks and other months. Indeed, it's DEET. And just for you chemistry buffs out there, it's N,N-diethyl-3-methylbenzamide. I carry that information in my back pocket. Not. But it is a toxin to preventing these mosquitoes, and could be toxic to the skin in very high concentrations for very long periods of time. So the general recommendation is use the concentration that you need for the length of time to prevent the exposure to the mosquitoes and the ticks that can cause those bites. And a lot of times it could be the lowest concentration, 10 to 30%, particularly for children.
Mm-hmm. 10% would last you about 2 hours, 30% about 5 hours. But you want to follow some basic rules with children. One, don't use it in children less than 2 months of age, if possible. When you use it, apply it to your own hands and then to them. Don't put it on their hands, and don't give them the spray bottle to squirt all over themselves.
And don't inhale it. Absolutely. And if you're out swimming or washing in the rain, sweating a lot, it's going to lose its effectiveness quicker, and you might need a reapplication. Well, thank you again. A very good question, and good luck in preventing those bites. Let's listen to our very next house call.
I am a 40-year-old woman, and I take Ambien for sleep. I heard something on the news recently about Ambien being a problem for women. Can you give me the scoop?
Thank you for asking this question. We haven't had a chance to talk about this yet on our show, but there has been more evidence showing that this medication, Ambien or Zolpidem, that people commonly take for insomnia or sleep problems, metabolizes or processes in the body differently for women than for men.
And so, whereas before you might have had a prescription for 10 milligrams of Ambien, which is kind of towards the upper limit of what we would recommend in any case, and now that upper limit is going to be lowered for women down to 5 milligrams. And so, because you don't want to be out there in the morning, perhaps still a little bit unsteady and driving a car, and there have been some accidents that are linked to this higher dose. And so I think it's a good thing to get people down on lower doses of these medicines. And I would even go beyond Ambien at that dose for women. I think it's probably true for most people. It's a lower dose is better.
Mm-hmm. You want to take the least effective dose, or try to find other sleep strategies to get off of it altogether.
Including, you know, non-medication ways of handling sleep problems that Christy and I really do talk about. We know some people really do need the Ambien, but there are a whole host of other strategies that can be tried.
We'll ask our super smart health sciences librarians to put up a post about non-medication-related sleep strategies.
That would be a super idea.
All right. Let's do our very last house call question about stomach pain and vomiting.
My husband has stomach pain, occasional vomiting, and salt water rising in his mouth. What could be the cause of that?
Salt water rising in the mouth. That, first off, sounds awful, and that would make me nauseous. That sounds like something's coming back up, and it sounds like regurgitation, reflux of acid. I don't know what you think, Christy.
No, I thought the same thing. It sounds like that, what we call GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, where that acid in your stomach sort of comes up into your esophagus and sometimes into your mouth and can give you a really bad taste.
Yeah. Our patients call it vomit. I mean, it's like, you know, and you know what that is. And this can be caused by a lot of things. A lot of times it's due to things in our diet, things like caffeine or chocolate or alcohol, all can be culprits.
It's also, you're alluding to changing some of the things in your life, what you eat, spicy foods, trying not to eat right before bed when you lay down.
Eating smaller meals too. Mm-hmm. Those big meals are a big cause of that. When we kind of overstuff our stomach and that valve that kind of protects that acid, stretch too much, can't do its work.
There are medications that you can get over the counter, like Prilosec, or some other medications you can get at the drugstore that can be helpful as well. But you'd like to start with some of the modifications in your life first.
Yep. Don't have a really big meal with chocolate and alcohol and coffee and then lay down right afterwards to go to bed. Not a good idea.
No. Thank you for your questions. We've talked a little bit about what sounds like reflux, about Ambien and women taking a lower dose.
About all sorts of ways to find out whether a chiropractic or an alternative provider is right for you, for any provider is right for you with their knowledge of expertise.
And about safety and DEET for children. Thank you for your questions and for joining us. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. Share your questions at yourhealth@unc.edu, on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, on our health app, or go to our blog, yourhealthradio.org.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for the sponsorship, and our guest today, Jerry Walter. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.